Hello and welcome to the Majlis podcast, Ready for Pure Liberties, current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis and Ready for Pure Liberties media manager here in Washington, D.C. Calm and order seems to have returned to Kazakhstan after the deadly protests. There have been lots of interpretation as to what happened, so we are not going to go there. Now, the bigger question is, at what cost the calm has returned to the country, what it means for Tokayev's government, and how people are coming to terms with a new reality. To discuss all this, I'm joined by Yevgeny Zhotys, the director of the Kazakhstan International Bureau for Human Rights and Rule of Law, Asia Tolesova, co-founder of the Oyan Kazakhstan Youth Movement, Dana Janay, the director of Kahraman, a human rights defending organization in Kazakhstan, and Bruce Panier, the editor of Ready for Peace and Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Colleagues, thank you very much for joining us today. So it's great to see most of our speakers today are joining us from Kazakhstan after days of internet blockage. It's such a refreshing to hear your first-hand perspective into what happened in the country and sort of grasp the ground reality as to the expectation going forward. So calm might have returned. How's the local feeling about the latest events in the way it ended up? Let's start with you, Yevgeny. Then I would like to take your point on the same question from each of you. So Yevgeny, let's start with you.
Probably we have to start with the general situation in the country. Of course, you're absolutely right. Situations became much more calm, but there is much more concerns. First of all, we have the problem with the accounting of really how many people are detained. I think that now we have from 2,000 to 3,000 in different regions, mostly in Almaty and the Almaty pretrial detention and other detention facilities. But another serious problem is how many people were killed and what happens sometimes with the bodies.
So they say the authorities say 225 people.
You could imagine that we have a lot of suspicion to everything what the government said. Until we will not have very clear, verified from independent sources the number of bodies and we start to collect this information, different organizations, different groups are trying to have very clear understanding how many people are killed and where they were killed and who these people were. They could be the militants, they could be the peaceful protesters, they could be occasionally happen at a certain place people. At this point, we have a lot of information about the mass torture, even not in the detention centers, but in some special facilities of the police or of the military, that there is a lot of questions which we do not have enough information about. But at this point, it looks like the violation of the rights is on the large scale. And what we are trying to do is to collect information and to help the people who are calling to us. Today, for example, we start to talk to the people whose relatives' bodies, which were buried, now are taken out of the places where they are buried for certain expertise. And now we are trying to get the help of the lawyers and the medical experts to be involved, because again, it's unclear where and how these people were killed. There is so many questions at this point that we could not get the answers until we will not have enough information, and official information at this point from our point of view is not relevant or not confirmed from independent sources.
So Zhenya, where you can get those information? What are the challenges of getting information? Let me put it in this way.
Of course, sometimes we have the official information, but specific information on individuals, talking to the police and the prosecutors. Secondly, we try to get the information from the relatives, from the people who provided this information, getting from the different social networks and then checking this information. We are trying to use any possible sources and to collect this information together. Finally, I could say that we created such kind of documentation center, 3 coalitions and 9 human rights organizations, and we will try to get this information to collect and to bring it together. And then probably we'll have some better sense of what is going on now and how we could find out how many people were killed, how many people are in detention, and what will go next.
Kind of the same question to both of you, Asia and Dana. Let's start with you, Dana. You know, it was really, really chaotic days during those events in Kazakhstan. So now we kind of understanding what really went on those days. So now that you are coping with the aftermath of those events as a human rights defender, human rights activists, so what kind of challenges are you facing and what are you seeing now that you didn't know before?
Yes, I was on this protest since January, at the beginning of the January, and I saw it's alive. And this protest, they started completely peaceful protests in the city of Zhanaozen, you know, and it happened when people came out after the holidays. And it's always about a fact when prices for gases grow up, it means that the prices for everything has grow up. So people started demanding some political changes, and very quickly this protest turned into political. So I'm in touch right now with many of activists, dozens of civilians who became victims of the torture or arbitrary detention, who seen mass shooting on peaceful civilians by law enforcement. And I also collected testimonies about looters and criminals who were groups closely controlled by police and special forces. And me, with my colleague, Foundation Kahramant, as well as Coalition Extremists, Not Extremists, we are monitoring right now the situation. We are collecting the names of the ones who was tortured, the ones who was killed. The relatives is calling us every single day. So our a list of the persecuted ones, of the died ones, of the killed ones is so big, so huge. And so we, in the close future, will publish it, but we can't stop collecting it because the names is not ending.
Wow. Asya, sort of a same question to you now. So what kind of situation are you dealing as the human rights activist in Kazakhstan these days in the aftermath of those events?
Well, I agree with Evgenia and Dana. I think the major concern now is that thousands of people have been detained and are under investigation. And the biggest problem is that these investigations are happening behind closed doors, and we have no access to information, like to full information. And we hear of cases when torture is used to get people to confess to something they didn't do, and that an awful practice. And many people are reported missing, and the government is very hesitant to let people in and reveal all the information about the losses among the civilians. But otherwise, I think the people are definitely happy that the situation has stabilized and life went back to normal. And I think many of them are willing to forgive Tokayev his mistakes, and as long as he lives up to their expectations, and expectations are great, and Tokayev has a lot to live up to.
Now, we are going to talk about the type of things that he was talking about lately, like the authorities should be accountable, responsible for people, and, talking about the gap between rich and poor being one of the main reason for the latest deadly events. So, Bruce, we are trying to read the brains of our speakers from Kazakhstan. Please jump in and ask any question you would like to ask in the context of the environment, in the context of this recent chaotic events in Kazakhstan.
The first thing I would point out is that that even the government's figure right now, right, 225, I've actually seen 227 lately also, but still makes it the worst incident of when law enforcement of one country went out and ended up shooting at citizens in Central Asia, in the last 30 years. I mean, that's more than Andijan. Now, okay, Andijan was one city and this is happening all over Kazakhstan, but still, that's the most deaths, at any time, anywhere in Central Asia in 30 years, involving the authorities. There's a million questions, and our speakers have already been talking about this, but as days go by, more and more people are released from detention and start talking about their experience, it seemed like beating them was the first thing that happened to them, While they were being detained, they were being beaten. And then they were taken into these places and being beaten again and asked questions. And, we have horrific photographs coming out. The Kyrgyz guy, the jazz musician who was obviously beaten up and confessed to being a terrorist, and said that he would paid to come over. He was unemployed. He was paid to come over to Kazakhstan and help cause trouble. And none of that was true at all. But I mean, it's such a heavy hand they've been using. And I don't see how they go forward for a long time with this, because it's really has echoes of Belarus. Belarus was much more brutal in some ways, I suppose, and more people were involved. But it's the same kind of thing, right? Where you, to restore order, you resort to maximum force across the way. And a lot of people that were, you know, the relatives of some of these people who were killed said that their relatives simply didn't know something was going on. They were walking down the street, they were driving home, something like that. The internet was down.
Yeah.
It was hard times with mobile phone connections. So these people were just going about their everyday life, and they were just shot because Tokayev had given shoot to kill orders without warning. You know, I mean, there's a lot to answer for here.
Yeah.
You know, these thousands of people that we are talking about here, I mean, you spoke about that they are being tortured. Any of them yet released so far? Have you seen anyone being released, like after questioning or something like that?
Is that, if that's for me, then no, I would say there are photographs of people who have been released.
For anyone, but perhaps our colleagues in Kazakhstan, maybe Yevgeny, have you met with anyone who has been released so far after being detained during those eventful days?
Yes, for sure. And not one.
Uh-huh.
Because we have the cases when the people were not charged with anything. They were detained either in square or nearby, or these were certain activists which were detained later. Then they were, for some time they were not beaten, at least in one case. Then they were beaten, he was beaten severely. And then after we raised a lot of noise about his whereabouts, because in this case it was well-known activist, so for one of the political groups. And when we raised a lot of concerns, he was found in Almaty City Department, and he was released in the evening, 3 days ago, absolutely beaten. We started, of course, procedure. We hired the lawyer for him. But what he's telling, it's terrible, because it was total impunity. This is, I agree totally with my colleagues and with Bruce, that this is the work of the same type of institution. This is one of the key problems. We have the same post-Soviet commercialized police, corrupted police, judiciary, prosecutor's office, and committee of security. And most beatings were happening with the special forces, not by the ordinary police as well, but generally by the special forces when the people were detained. Then a lot of people were released, and most of them were beaten in that or another way. The trade unionists, the journalists, and so on. This is general pattern, because the law enforcement feel themselves absolutely, they have free hands. They think that now they could move, go after everybody. And I don't know whether you know about that, but there was cases when it was typical bribe-taking for release, when the person was detained on the street, his telemobile was seized, they found some kind of video at his phone, and they said that if you will not pay, you will be arrested for terrorist suspicion of terrorism or mass disorder.
How widespread was that? Okay, go ahead.
In Almaty, it was widespread, all these, let's say, so seizing of mobiles and then detaining people. But it's another difficult issue. You ask me about what are the challenges. The challenges are the people are so afraid that even in the case, we have very clear beaten, the leg is broken, but the people don't want to write complaint. They are afraid that it will be worse, that they are relatives, their children, 21 years old, 20 years old, will be arrested and so on. And people don't want even to address the issue to us, and then lately to the authorities. They do not trust, and they feel themselves that it's better, if you are not killed, it's better not to raise the issue. And it's another huge challenge we are facing.
I feel, Dana, you have things to add into this one. Please do feel free to add. And also, you know, 10,000 or more, perhaps, this is the official figure, I guess, 10,000 plus people, let's put it this way, the ones who are detained earlier. What I'm trying to say is here, like, you know, each of that 10,000 people, 10,000 plus people, have their own story behind what they went through. And also, other leg of my question here is, I mean, those 10,000 or plus people, they, all of them cannot be activists. 10,000 is too many people. I mean, who were they? And do even they know why they were detained?
Yes, all over the country were detained a lot of people, and there was not even into politics. There was just simple civilians, like doctors, there were architects and attorneys, even attorneys in Kazalardam, and even activists and civil activists and former political prisoner. For example, Aset Abishev, he was severely beaten by by representatives of the National Security Committee, or maybe by representatives of police department. maybe, and he was severely beaten, even delivered by an ambulance with a pulmonary diagnosis of closed intracranial injury and brain contusion of the soft tissues of the back, as I remember. And a lot of people was not into politics before, and right now his wife is calling us, and they say, what's going on? We just tried to buy antibiotics and so on. And during this wait, our husband was detained or so on. So many stories, different stories. So we will, of course, continue to work with international partners and politicians to restore the chronology of events and bring those responsible for the mass repressions of civilians to justice.
That's a horrific story. Asia, earlier, Jenya kind of hinted to this. I mean, police using this situation as an opportunity to bribe people. Yeah, what are the other examples that you can share, kind of firsthand examples you can share, the type of situation that people went through these days? Well, let me put it this way. I'm sure that you were outside on the streets during those events.
I went to a peaceful march on January 4th. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, we were detained and brought to the police station where I spent the night and was released only the next day.
How that evolved, Asia? I mean, you were on the streets and protesting. Then what happened?
On the evening of the 4th of January, we went to a peaceful march with a young Kazakhstan. Uh-huh. And in total, we were like... I think there were around 100 people. Mm. And we only marched for... We started our march towards the city center, but we were detained like in like 15 to 20 minutes. We were detained, as it always happened, and brought to a police station where I spent the night. And so I wasn't really a part of the big protest that had happened that night, the big march. But from what I've heard from my friends and the journalists who participated in the march, it was a peaceful march that they even describe it as a notice. Well, people were very happy and very a feeling of solidarity, and they marched towards the city center, the city hall, and where they said they were attacked, well, tear gassed basically, and I think that was a provocation on behalf of the government, caused the violence that followed. I haven't witnessed it myself, so I'm just telling you what I've heard from my friends and who participated in the march that day.
Right. You know, this peaceful protests taking the street and then suddenly things turning violent. Of course, there has to be a link between that. I mean, how that happened. Maybe perhaps, Virginia, you could talk about that. Earlier, I heard you being quoted in a number of platforms talking about those protests turning deadly. I'm kind of trying to visualize this event, Yevgeny. I mean, peaceful protests taking the street and with certain demands, and suddenly bloodshed starts. Describe us the process in which a peaceful protest kind of turning into violent. What happens in between?
First of all, I want to add something to what was said by Asia and by Dana, because what another case of, of brutal reaction we have seen. I'm living in the center of the city, two blocks from the hospital where the people were held who were wounded. Probably some of them were people who attacked police station, somebody were innocent people. It's very difficult to say who these people were. I only could guess now. But these people were wounded and were held to this hospital. And the special forces in masks entered this hospital, beaten some of them, and took all of them from the beds in the hospital to the pretrial detention center. We are now in peace in two cases. We are now trying to assist the lawyers to raise the issues of torture and so on. The authorities said that they got some medical assistance and treatment inside the pretrial detention center, and even some surgery which they are brought to the civic hospital and then brought back. But in general, what we have already credible information that they were beaten, being wounded. They were beaten by the people in masks and taken to the pretrial detention center. Now turning how it turns violent. First of all, we have to be very clear that it did not happen in all cities. or in all places of peaceful protest. Somewhere like in Aktau, it did not turn violent and nobody was arrested except two cases. It was different in different parts of the country, but what I'm saying in all platforms and in all my interviews, that we have to look at the current legislation on peaceful assemblies. Because any person who went to the central square is automatically administrative offender. He is already committed administrative offense, because even peacefully you could not gather in other places except specially designed. That any person who went to the street or have the march not in the specialized route is already violating the law. That practically what the authorities used to do during all these several years of protest, they were using kettling, they were detaining, they were any time, they were probably not with a big force, but usually they're detaining people. That first of all, police used force against peaceful protesters even before. That when this march came to the street in the night of 4th, I was in the permanent contact by phone with a number of the protesters and with our monitors, because we have monitors from our organization in practically all regions of the country. And in some regions, first of all, police start, like in Almaty, it starts using stun grenades and the gas against the protesters. And then they were infiltrated by the other groups, which were already not peaceful protesters, and which combined to some extent from some marginalized group of youth, which also was in the beginning peaceful, and then some militant groups, criminals and some others, and provocators. This all together starts to turn it violent in the night from 4th to 5th. And on 5th and then 6th, it was already, from my point of view, organized not as a peaceful marches and protests. The peaceful protesters exist, but not in big numbers. And mostly it were crowds infiltrated by the militant groups with a certain chain of commands, which have their own, let's say, so agenda, especially, I think, and it turned, from my point of view, to a certain extent, to inter-elite conflict, because these groups clearly were close to the local elites. And it happens in some, in different cities, on different scale and different grounds, but not in all.
I think that... I think the problem is that the government still doesn't give us access to information to understand what had happened. Like, and we all of us have different theories about what happened that day, but we are not 100% sure about any of them.
We're
just making assumptions, but that's why we insist on open investigations and open data, and our government being transparent and about the investigation processes that are happening now.
Right. In terms of those detained people, there are a couple of questions there I have in mind. Let me start here. So one is, has the process of detaining people stopped already, or they are still being rounded up?
Still being
who are
but
they?
Not on a very large scale, much less scale, but still underway.
Who they are rounding up? I mean, who they are chasing up?
They are watching the video from the different video cameras and so on, and as more they could identify certain people in this video, especially video close to some shops where they could find some looters and so on. Or they are looking very carefully, and you could imagine that they are carefully looking person by person at the central square, for example, in Almaty. They are watching what the people are doing, and we are getting information that when they are identifying people, they start to detain them. What I also want to say that starting from the detention, even from the beginning, the procedural norms were not observed. The lawyers were not allowed to visit their clients. There was no access to the telephone calls and to inform their relatives. Sometimes they did not even fill in the protocols, and they are not allowing people to get medical treatment or to be, let's say, so observed about their bruises and so on, which the law demands to do. That we could say that starting from probably 7th and 8th until 12th or 13th, there was practically lawlessness and practically many rights were violated. Now they are still trying to follow something, but it's very difficult to say because, as already was said, we do not have enough information. And that's why we start to collect information with our friends. And I know that the speakers also have their information. We'll try to collect it together, but of course without independent investigation by the commission, a fact-finding mission with the foreign experts internationally recognized, it will be very difficult to establish what happens.
Dana, you have a Kahraman group, the human rights defending organization, and people must be contacting you as well, like they do Zhenya. So what kind of questions people have?
Yeah, they're looking for help. Let's start from this. And I want to add, today the wife of one attorney called me, and she told me her story. Her husband, Adilhan Bidinbaev, his family links the political persecution of her husband to the fact that as an attorney, he criticized the Kazalarda police and prosecutor's office, and now the authorities are politically persecuting him under the guise of an anti-terrorist operation. And Adilhan Bilhanov he's just a father for, and he was never have been in politics and did not participate in the peaceful protests in Kazalarda. During these days, he stayed at home with his family, and during the protest, his car was stolen because he lives with the family near the site of the protest. And he filled a report to the police, and the police responded that the car was impounded and that he could retrieve it, but he was already detained on January 11. It is also reported that a map and drawing of the prison building were found in the glove compartment of his car, and a politically motivated criminal case was probably been opened against him. Yes, so we get more and more facts of political persecution of not only from activists, human rights defenders, or peaceful protests, ordinary people who did not take part in the protest, but also lawyers. So,
You know, earlier Tokayev was also heard talking about like civil society or media playing their role behind the recent unrest. Now that being an activist, Asiya, my question is to you, being an activist, are you afraid of someone knocking on your door?
Well, right now, I think it was after the Tokayev's speech on the January 7th, where he tried to blame activists for igniting the protest, basically the violent protest. I think, I should say that I panicked a little bit, but I think that Tokayev panicked himself, and what he said that day, I think he didn't ever repeat that ever again in his statements. So I don't feel threatened, but I'm not so confident about other activists and human rights defenders and journalists. And
What about Dana? Dana and Yevgeny, to you, I mean, are you scared? Are you threatened? Like you guys said, I mean, they are still chasing activists and rounding them up with different excuses. So what goes through your mind when you see those kind of stories, that they are still after those activists?
You know, it's today it's all about fear, maybe. I'm living like I'm sitting on the suitcase right now, and I'm waiting that police officers will come to me and took me to the police or something like that, because I was in the protest during these days. But, you know, I'm a public person, and publicity is an effective method of protecting human rights in the face of political persecution. So I know that if they will detain me, that people will not leave me alone. And it's like we're living in 1937 during the Stalin times. Everyone, I think, inside they're scary that police officer will come after them, and they care about surveillance and so on. So that's what's
On that, Zhenya, so you guys are, as you know, Dana was talking about, you guys have this public persona, you are public personalities, perhaps that might be one element of protection in your case, but there are lots of people who do not have that kind of protection, and they are still threatened.
We are not sure any time. That's the question, was to what extent we are not sure, what could happen. We are not sure because in 2009 I was arrested, which where I should not be, or then some others were the attempts to close our organizations. That we are not sure any time. You are living in the authoritarian state, which is probably more or less soft, and it's not making repression on the large scale. But targeted repression, it's possible, and sometimes even your publicity could not protect you to the extent you want. And sometimes, you know, that some people have to even to leave the country and now somewhere abroad, including journalists and so on. That you are not sure. Yes, now the threat is not so imminent, or you could not see some kind of real desire of government or the intention of government to go after the journalists or after the civic activists and the human rights defenders, as President said on 7th, but then dropped this kind of rhetoric. It was political rhetoric. But what concerns me, it's about some activists, especially of political organization, of the band, the CKN, Kershe, Partia Si, of the some other groups, political groups, because the authorities could use this situation to limit their ability to be involved in politics or to do any kind of political activism. And then we should see, yes, they promise that they will not go after the peaceful protesters, but at this point we have a lot of cases, and I think Herman also have a lot of cases, when the protesters against whom there is no any kind of evidence of violence and so on, already are detained, already are charged with the mass disorder, if not the seizure of the state property or the attack of the police. And finally, even if you were not involved in the protests physically, if you disseminate certain information, if you're involved in posters, videos and so on, you could be charged with the dissemination of false information. And this makes all activists vulnerable in that regard, if you disseminate any information and so on. And we have also some cases when the people were detained on the charges under this Article 274, dissemination of false information.
Bruce, is there anything I'm missing in this context?
No, I've been fascinated to follow the conversation. And I know we got to wrap it up pretty soon. I think the big problem, one of the big problems with this is that we'll probably never get any real answers on a lot of this stuff. There's so many things that went wrong. Like I said, the shoot to kill without warning order is really, really bad. If, you know, they could have even run cars through there with loudspeakers or something saying, get off the street. You know, it's a state of emergency. You shouldn't be out or something. But so many of these people just had no idea that there was anything going on or anything wrong. And, you know, the law enforcement or just shot at them. You know, they didn't get any warning. What are you doing? Go home. Something like that. I mean, they just opened fire on them. And this is horrible. And I can't imagine there's any way the authorities can justify that this happened. The problem is going to be that there won't be, I doubt there'll be an independent commission that investigates this and finds out. And there probably won't be any police or law enforcement reforms that keep it from happening again. I mean, the shoot to kill order should just be out.
They
got to develop a system where if something like this happens, they can communicate with the population and let them know that, you know, to stay indoors or something like that. But they shut down the internet, like I said, and they shut down the phones. I'm not saying there wasn't a legitimate threat to the security of the public. For instance, people had guns, they were shooting. But you can't just open fire on anyone on the street or anyone driving on the road because in one part of the city, there's people with guns shooting. That's not legitimate.
You remember in our previous conversation, like one of our speakers told us kind of a personal first-hand story of one of her relatives being killed, who was not even protesters, who just happened to be there, and he got killed. And he was shot at, and he got killed. You know, this also kind of brings us to this question, you know, what comes next and what kind of legitimacy question it's going to raise going forward to Tokayev's government, and what and how he's going to get out of this messy situation. Perhaps with these two questions, we are going to round up the conversations very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis podcast, I'm joined by Yevgeny Jyotish, the director of Kazakhstan International Bureau for Human Rights and Rule of Law, Asiya Tolesova, co-founder of the Oyan Kazakhstan Youth Movement, Dana Janay, the director of Kahraman, a human rights defender, and Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Pride Liberties, Central Asia blog, Kishlok Oazi. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Arif Yaralu's media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing in the context of recent events what comes next in Kazakhstan. So, It's been a messy couple of weeks, as we heard from all of you. Now we are learning kind of the full extent of what went on since the internet was blocked in those days. And now that eyewitnesses like you guys are speaking about and joining the conversation about Kazakhstan, we are really grateful to have you back in this conversation. So how things can get back to normal after these messy situation? It's a kind of open question to anyone.
I think it's a guy's going to have very rough time trying to win back the trust of people. And the only way he can try to do it is to actually initiate the political reforms he's been talking about all these years, and by allowing the registration of new political parties, allowing open and fair elections, decentralizing power, giving back the power to the parliament, to the people. I mean, he knows what to do. I mean, he's talked about it a lot. People have so many questions, and it's not only, I mean, Tokayev has to do like this, and he has to do, but he has to, and I mean, and people shouldn't let him off the hook, and should demand the changes and insist on them.
Yevgeny and Asia, both of you, and feel free to jump in here. I mean, what kind of lesson, let's put that question for later, in terms of Kazakhstan getting back to normalcy, what he can do about it?
Probably I will jump in. First of all, you start with the lessons. I think that one of the lessons which should be learned, I remind, is that. I remind you the Zhanaozian events. In spite of the fact of a lot of calls for international commission to check what happens from the UN Human Rights Commissioner, from the UN Human Rights Committee, from many of them, nothing happened. If our government and Tokayev personally will not learn this lesson, that there is a need to have thorough, objective, impartial investigation of what happens, it will be very difficult to come to normalcy, even if you will manage to keep the order, restore the order, and so on. That's first of all, we have to know what happens, and everybody, including the government, which has a lot of flaws and mistakes, including the law enforcement, including all the governmental bodies, to find out who and how and why it happens and what happens and so on, it will be very difficult to overcome this situation. It was shock, it was total mess, and so many people, Bruce already mentioned, so many people were killed, which is for the first time in the whole Kazakh history of this country. Secondly, I think that what he needs to do, for sure, of course, all political reforms are needed, but what is absolutely important, to reform the whole system, legal system of the country, law enforcement and judiciary. Until we will not have the law enforcement under the control, we will still have the police state with the same consequences. If we will have not independent judiciary, we will still in the same place, no matter to what extent we will make again economical reforms, try to restore some social justice and so on. Because it's interlinked things. And of course, it's linked to the political pluralism, political inclusion, and normal system of checks and balances, separation of power. There is no any other option.
Yeah, he's talking about something like this. I guess he's going to come back to it in September, that he will announce the package of reforms and things like that. Does that package include any of the things that you have been talking about, Yevgeny?
We don't know.
We don't know, yeah.
And this is why I was, because you want to provide, to make some kind of concrete portfolio of the political reforms, and you want to announce it in September, at least show us the trends, what you are planning to do in general, now, not in 9 months. And he didn't say that, of course. And this is, for me, this is critical, and this is a problem at this point. We don't know.
I don't think he has the time. I think he has to act now. I mean, because the problems are still there. Yeah. I mean, he has to act now, and that he doesn't have the time. I think he has to act now.
Time is essential. I mean, how much time he got to act on that?
I don't know. I mean, I agree with Yevgeny with everything he said. I mean, we need all these reforms, and he has to show us now, like right now, not in 9 months, but tomorrow. We want to see. Him doing the things he should be doing yesterday.
Yeah. You know, he's also talking about these some right stuff, like, you know, the earlier I referred to, one of them being gap between rich and poor being the reason behind recent deadly events. You know, does that give you any kind of hope that he might be grasping the kind of seriousness of the situation?
I hope so. I mean, there's no other way for him. I hope he does realize how serious the situation is. And I hope he acts soon. That's basically it.
Okay. Yevgeny,
I think that we have to keep in mind that Mr. Tokayev was the prime minister in the early 2000s. That to a certain extent, he is the part of this system.
Yes.
At least I could not say the builder, but the part of this system. On one hand, he understands how the system looks like. Economical system from the point of social justice, legal system, and so on. The question is, A, He have to declare a very clear vision to the people what he's planning to do, not only economically, but politically as well. And second, we have to assess what resources and potential he has, to what extent, because there is a lot of interest of the elites inside this system. A lot of system was built for 30 years by Mr. Nazarbayev and his allies and so on. That how to destroy this system, it's a very difficult task. But the people are tired. And what happens in this January, besides turning violent, it was exactly the sign that people are tired in large numbers and all around the country. That he has to send the right messages and to start to implement them as quick as possible. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, the level of trust, keeping in mind that he is from the same team, being in the government for a long time, that it will be, the level of trust will be lower and lower and lower every week, if not day.
Mm. We need to end the conversation. Bruce, so there are some hopes, and according to our speakers, Tokayev do not have much time to act on what he has been talking about on many other issues that our colleagues have indicated. Is there anything you would like to add in terms of how he is going to get out of this mess, and also where your eyes will be going forward in terms of what he does next?
Well, I certainly agree that he does not have much time. He needs to come up not only with a reform plan, but one that differs significantly from what we've seen. I mean, Yevgeny made the very good point that he is part of the system. Now, when people went out on the street and they were chanting "Shall cut," all right, that when that started, that was directed specifically against Nazarbayev. But what it came to mean was the whole system that Nazarbayev that developed when Nazarbayev was there. They want an end to that. So Tokayev has to come up with a reform package that's a departure, something new from what the people have been seeing out there. And really to emphasize how little time he's got, you know, once again, with the Shalkat and stuff, Shalkat, that kind of chant, you know, the people want to realize that they've been getting, the money's been stolen from the country for years and years, you know, and they haven't gotten very much of the riches of the land, and they know who's responsible for that. Now, up to this point, we've seen no indication on the part of Tokayev that he's willing to bring any members of the Nazarbayev family or Nazarbayev's cronies to justice, to investigate them and see how much money they stole and how they were able to do that. He hasn't indicated that's going to be part of it at all, which is not going to be very satisfying to all the people that were protesting. That's what they wanted, an end to that, and that the people that were responsible for it would be held accountable for that. So he's not going to do that, which means if he doesn't come up with a reform package that's something new real quick, he's going to have a lot of problems, because he's going to fail to satisfy the public on almost every count that you can imagine.
Right. Yeah, let's see what he does when he does it. But one thing seems to be clear to me, that these 2-3 weeks has changed a lot in Kazakhstan. Let's keep our eyes on where things go from here. With this, unfortunately, we have to conclude the conversation, but we will keep our eyes on in terms of what comes next. So thank you very much, Yevgeny Zhevtis, the director of the Kazakhstan International Bureau for Human Rights and Rule of Law, Asiya Tolesova, co-founder of OYAN Kazakhstan, Dana Janay, the director of Kahraman, a human rights defending organization, and Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Republic of Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Thank you very much, colleagues, for joining us today. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Republic of Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. Until next week, bye-bye.